Minute, Larry, so you can dial me in. Sounds pretty close, huh? Getting some notation that I need to raise it. Is that a little better? And how about now? What's that doing? Is that improving things? We're on. Good morning, brethren and young people. We're embarking on an adult subject this morning. It's given so much play in Scripture and historically that obviously we know that the situation of David, Bathsheba, and the murder of Uriah is a critical event that's been preserved for all history to ruminate upon, and I submit it's a pithy subject for the young people, and I will handle the subject as tactfully as I can. We will be working out of 2 Samuel chapter 11. This is a sad story to tell of a great man with the prominence of David in the purpose of God's plan. This incident with Bathsheba, coupled with the premeditated murder of Uriah, is the watershed of David's life. Incidentally, we might say that the exactness and the thoroughness in preserving this account is witness to the authenticity of the Bible, as we might assume that the Hebrew scholars and writers of old would have sought to scrub this account from Scripture if they thought they could get away with it. The account is graphic and it's chock full of advice for all saints of every age. If such a great and faithful servant of God can fall in this manner, how easy might be we of lesser stature to manifest the similar frailty in the circumstances of our life. It's a treatise on sin management. So we're in 2 Samuel chapter 11. Now let's go to James 1 for just a minute, and we'll remind ourselves of the familiar path of sin that we all know, and we're reading from James 1, verse 12 to 15. Blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord hath promised to them that love him. An encouragement right up front. The crown of life is still available. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he in any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. So we have the three phases here spelled out for us in James 1. There are three phases in the path of sin. The first one being mental. The mind becomes engaged in something is hatched or dwelt upon for too long a time. Two, it's moral. A breach is hatched contrary to God's law and it's acted upon. Three, it becomes physical. Repercussions occur. And if of sufficient magnitude and not forgiven, death is the result. Now we've got some generalities here that I want to cover. It makes no difference how spiritually healthy we may be and have been for many years. There are certain factors that can come together and make shipwreck of our lives. So no one has the option to say, I've been baptized for 20 years and been in the truth and I've done all this and that. and that I'm home free. This is true financially, is it not? Things can come together that can make shipwreck of our lives financially. It's true physically, if we contract a disease or have dangerous habits. But in this account, we're speaking about morality and spirituality. As was the custom in those days, the nations conducted war at opportune seasonal times and during the winter months, which tended to be the rainy season in Israel, the war stopped. Now you can look in 2 Samuel 10 and you can see why David was at home and why there was a season for war and a season not for war. David over in 2 Samuel 10 had desired to show a kindness unto Hanun. And this is a trait of David, and we'll consider that later, if we may, when David desired to show a kindness to any descendant of Saul's house. And you recall when he sent his emissaries for the condolences to the king of Ammon, that in verse 3, the advice given by the younger advisors in the kingdom had planted the seed. Thinkest thou that David doth to honor thy father, that he hath not sent comforters unto thee? Hath not David rather sent his servants unto thee to search the city and to spy it out and to overthrow it? Bad advice, and the older or elder listened to it. Now, this occasion, therefore, has David, for some reason, at home rather than back in the battle, at the front, finishing the conflict with the Ammonites, who had a very fortified two-tiered city, and the lower portion of the city was taken in the first year, and they had to come back now and finish the matter and take the stronghold. It's often a time or season of comparative idleness when one can fall into temptation and do something foolish, and this was the case of David. Jesus spoke to this in a parable, and it was in Matthew 12, verse 43 to 45. Then goeth he and taketh with himself other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter in and dwell there, and the last state of that man is worse than the first. Even so shall it be also unto this wicked generation. Verse 43 picks up the content better. When the unclean spirit is gone out of a man, he walketh through the dry places, seeking rest, and findeth none. So, the point being made here, this is a parable about self-reformation without reliance upon God. We think we can clean up our act, but if we're not in prayerful contact with Yahweh, then we're not going to clean it up sufficiently to prevent more sin or the reoccurrence of a problem to creep back in and make things even worse. Now, although it was about a self-sufficient Israel, it applies to ourselves as well when we tend to drift spiritually. A spiritual lull can create a vacuum that will be filled with something. Trust me on that one. A spiritual vacuum will be filled with something. This is what Jesus meant in Luke 19:13, the parable of the 10 pounds, quoting, "And he called his 10 servants and delivered to them 10 pounds and said unto them, Occupy till I come. Or, put my gospel to work. Use it. Keep busy." Now, the sin of adultery and murder as a cover-up is about as bad as it gets, yet the typical human mind and that of David's was of no exception, in that he had obviously laundered this. So I'm in 2 Samuel 12 now, and I'm going to read from verse 1 to 9, and this is where Nathan the prophet comes to David and rebukes him through the story that proceeds as such. And the Lord sent Nathan unto David, and he came unto him and said unto him, there were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The poor man was Uriah. The rich man had very many flocks and herds, that being David. But the poor man had nothing save one little ewe lamb, and that was his lovely wife Bathsheba, which he had bought and nourished up, and it grew up together with him and with his children. It did eat of his own food and drank of his own cup and lay in his bosom and was unto him as a daughter. Now, skipping to verse 5, David is incensed by this story. He thinks it's going on now in his kingdom, which it was. And David's anger was greatly kindled against the man. And he said to Nathan, as the Lord liveth, the man who hath done this thing shall surely die. And in 7, just as Daniel pegged Nebuchadnezzar, Nathan said here, thou art the man. So he tied the can directly to David. And that's why I say David had up to this point effectively laundered what he had done. Our deceitful conscience is capable of that kind of thing, is it not? And that's one thing that's scary about standing at the Bema. It's how many things have we laundered in our own mind that might be revealed to us? Now, our gleaning then of 2 Samuel 11 detects really 10 areas that factors into David's sin. There's a whole process or list of circumstances, and I want to look at these. As in most cases, it's the battleground in our minds. Now, this list is a list of many things that can all come together and to generate a situation like David experienced. The first one I want to look at is procrastination, which means to delay or to put off. In verse 1, it came to pass after the year was ended and at the time when kings go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Raba, but David tarried still in Jerusalem. David had been delayed for some reason. What made him tarry or loiter in Jerusalem? What was going on in his head to make him tarry so long while his men went off to the battlefront? Was he coasting a little and neglecting his responsibilities and his duty? Was he bored with his routine, having too much time on his hands? When we are not doing God's work per se, we will find someone else's work to do, won't we? In this case, David was loitering on the roof of his palace and happened to notice the lovely Bathsheba next door taking a bath. It's hard to believe that up until this time he was oblivious to the fact that a lovely lady resided in that house next door. Or maybe up until now he was oblivious because he was too busy in a productive manner. The next point we'll consider is location. For the occasion of sin to manifest itself is too often being in the wrong place at the wrong time. We all have blushes with danger and sin, don't we, on a regular basis. By that I mean we can get hit with a ricochet without becoming involved. But in verse 2, David had been apparently sleeping longer that day and got up in the late afternoon. And it came to pass at eventide that David arose from his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house. That in itself is a symptom of something. People who tend to sleep or nap through the day. Regarding adultery, one logically doesn't, of course, hang out at bars, discos, places where things can easily sprout. The world is filled with places which encourage sin. And so it's very important for us, regarding our surroundings, being aware of our surroundings, being mindful of places we go. In these times, people who work late, work alone, jog alone in secluded places, need to be aware of their surroundings. Our haunts have a lot more to do with our character than we often realize. Our haunts have a lot more in revealing our character than we might realize. The third consideration is entitled laziness. In verse 2, it said, it became to pass in eventide that David arose from off his bed. For David to be sleeping until eventide was sheer laziness, and laziness gives great advantage to the tempter to occasion a diversion. In Matthew 13:25, we're reminded, standing water gathers filth. The welfare society of our nation is characterized by laziness, which not only explains its continual need of financial help, but also their habitual stats of immorality and crime. Samson found that laziness was costly, was it not? A little extra sleep on Delilah's lap ruined him. Laziness lowers one's guard to lust and encourages experimentation. Point number 4 is immodesty. David from the roof saw a woman washing herself, and the woman, we're told, was very beautiful to look upon. Rooftops in those times were similar to decks today. Bathsheba's immodesty, I submit, was a major factor in this adulterous affair. She was bathing where she could be seen and was in full view of David's rooftop. Some will say it was David's problem, yet Bathsheba had to know that David by now had an eye for lovely women. One commentator suggested that she was an ambitious, immodest woman who laid a snare for David. Maybe that's a little harsh, but immodesty and immodest women know what they are doing and are a snare to men. That's a man's weakness. Bathsheba lacked the qualities of an Abigail, did she not? In 1 Samuel 25, verse 3, where Abigail was described as a woman of good understanding and of a beautiful countenance. So over the centuries, men have sold their souls to flirtatious women. Look at our politicians, for example, in our government, and imagine the routine. We're told in Genesis 6, verse 2, the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took of them wives from all. Now, today, immodesty is flaunted in clothes, magazines, tabloids, movies, TV, and in this case, Bathsheba was naked. Men are vulnerable in this area. It's a fact. Next point, point number five I want to consider is control of vision or control of one's eyes. David looked upon Bathsheba, we're told in verse 2. He took a good, long, contemplative look. This is contrasted with the word saw, which means to glimpse. Psalms 119, verse 37 reads, "Turn away mine eyes from beholding vanity, and revive thou me in thy way." Job knew this way back then. He knew this principle when he said in chapter 31, quote, "I made a covenant with mine eyes. Why then should I think upon a maid? I made a covenant with mine eyes." What we allow our eyes to contemplate will control our life. Therefore, we need to have a strong spiritual vision, a brain controlling what we see rather than the eyes controlling our brains. If our head is full of vivid visions of the plan of God and His coming kingdom, and young people, I say, start ruminating and chewing upon the visions in Zechariah, for example, the visions in Daniel chapter 7, the various beasts. These things may occupy our minds, and we may always take a little trip in our minds and visit a vision of Yahweh in deference to or in crowding out the things we see in the world. We can practice visualization based upon the plan and purpose of God to counter all of the visual imagery that we are bombarded with in the world. You know, years ago, visualization was the big buzz in athletics. Visualize yourself hitting a ball well. Visualize yourself skiing well. Visualize yourselves in the kingdom. Studies suggest most people are visual learners today just because of the blitz of objects and TV we get from childhood. Kids in general don't read that much anymore and therefore don't build mind bridges to the glory of God. And I like that phrase, mind bridges. In Hebrews 12:2, we are told to look unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. And in turn, what did Jesus look to? He looked for the glory that lay before him. What does the figure of the cherubim eagle suggest? Supreme eyesight and the capacity to look into the future and to see the kingdom. What are we seeing? So parents, talk about visions to your children. Help your teens read these passages and sit and discuss them. That's why we have this type of divine teaching, not only in words and text, but in vivid visions. Television is, of course, the monster that is a known corrupter and an eye snare for all of us. As David looked upon Bathsheba, we may conclude that his thoughts were not innocent. So this brings us to point number six, our thought process. David sent and inquired about the woman, we're told in verse 3. You see how sin hath conceived? He sent and inquired about the woman, and one said, "Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah, the Hittite?" So, this takes us back to James 1, verse 8, where we're told, "A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways." And in verse 15, then, of James 1, "When our lust have conceived, we are ripe for sin, and when sin runs its course, we may become the victims unto death." Our thought life are the seeds and roots of our conduct. We are the product of our thought life. Recall, one of the problems of Noah's day, and consequently ours, is that every imagination of the thoughts of their heart was only evil continually. And we live in the day of Noah, and we can see what's going on. When you watch the evening news, you have to listen to a litany of heinous crimes that have been either in process or have been recently committed. Jeremiah rebuked the people in Jerusalem in Jeremiah 4, verse 14, when he said, O Jerusalem, wash thine heart from wickedness, that thou mayest be saved. How long shall thy vain thoughts lodge within thee? He took it right to the mind. David let his thought life take him down, abandon the trail that was to mar his entire life, his reputation, and subsequently his ability to rule. Don't let your thoughts ruin your life. We all have another law within our members, warring against the law of God which we have placed in our mind. The next area is disrespect. And this then comes from verse 3 as well, regarding David's inquiry. David inquired after the woman and said, Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliah, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? And we might add, one of his elite mighty men. And David took her, we're told. Now on the surface it looks as if David was trying to do the appropriate thing. He inquired who she was and is she married and so forth. And he was told she was the wife of Uriah the Hittite, in essence, one of your mighty men. But his noble appearance and inquiry vanished when he continued to pursue her, though he learned that she was another loyal man's wife. This suggests that David was not that interested if she was married, rather than was her husband, Uriah, home. But he was at Reba, the capital of Ammon, where David should have been. Uriah was a mighty warrior. He was one of David's elite corps who would go to Hades and back for him. Adultery by the act means that there is immense disrespect for at least two parties involved. How about David's court, his family members, his countrymen? How about Yahweh? To disregard his statutes, thou shalt not commit adultery and thou shalt not kill, were huge. And this is why God, because of David's apparent ability to whitewash all of these implications, finally had to send Nathan to jingle his conscience. Once there is a disrespect for the word of God, a relaxing of urgency, a loss of reverence and fear, disobedience often follows. To commit adultery shows disrespect for all involved. Point number 8, companions. There is a measure of protocol and propriety, we would suggest, between people who have a moral and an ethical spine. If we rub shoulders with people in the world, there are people whom we prefer to be around and people who we find absolutely disgusting. The good people, the moral people in the world make life pleasurable to a little degree, does it not? David and Bathsheba should have had a strong spiritual spine. David should have thrown up his hands upon learning that Bathsheba was Uriah's wife and said, Whoa, you know. Go on home. There should have been brakes put on immediately. Likewise, Bathsheba, even in the presence of her king, should have said something to the effect that, with all respect, you know that I am married, and my husband Uriah is in your army now serving you in Ramah. And she should have turned on her heels and walked out. But she was all too cooperative. It was mutual consent, not a rape. She responded to his request without any hesitation. Choose your companions based upon their inner qualities. David was going totally by unchecked lust. Bathsheba is not free from blame at all in this situation. She was likewise motivated by lust and the excitement of being invited to the king's deck and so forth and so on. Next, point number 9 is values. In verse 4, and David sent messengers and took her, and she came in unto him, and he lay with her, for she was purified from her uncleanness. She was purified from her uncleanness. The Hebrew states that, and she purified herself from her uncleanness. Now, there are two situations that this would apply to, where a woman must be purified under the law after her cycle and after lying with her husband, as in Leviticus 18 and Leviticus 15. Because Uriah was away at the front, she was telling David that she was cleansed from the former and in essence that she was available. Bathsheba was careful to obey the straining at a gnat and swallowing a camel, was he not? She put more emphasis on being physically clean at this moment than on being morally clean. In the woe chapter, you recall, of Matthew 23, Jesus lists 7 woes of the hypocritical scribes and Pharisees who, in essence, made clean the outside of a cup, and within it's all full of extortion and excess and so forth. The religious leaders of Israel illustrated this when they went to great lengths to engineer the death of Jesus, yet outwardly observing the ceremonial law, for, quote, they themselves went not into the judgment hall lest they should be defiled, that they might eat of the Passover. More obvious is the flair, we might say, in our society over, say, a Picasso picture, which is a picture of a grotesque nose with an eye on it, where somebody just paid $5 million for it. It's like the fairy tale of the emperor's new clothes. There was nothing there, no substance. Solomon could see this when he told us repeatedly, vanity, vanity, or of no lasting consequence. Vanity of vanity. Meaning there is nothing to it. Today, values are up for grabs on every front. And we can say, witness the hypocrisy and corruption of our government. Everything is situational. Number 10, lastly, is disloyalty. And we have a little overlap on some of these. But as stated earlier, David showed great disloyalty to both Uriah and Eliam, his father-in-law, and himself, who was one of David's mighty men. Uriah and his father-in-law, his father Eliam, were one of David's mighty men, all listed in the registry of David's mighty men or elect soldiers, 37 of them, in 2 Samuel 23. To take Uriah's wife and to then orchestrate his death sent an appalling message rippling through David's kingdom. Likewise, Bathsheba was disloyal to her husband as well. Loyalty will stop adultery cold. So we are to keep holy loyalties all our life, to God even unto death, and to our mates until death do us part. The same applies to the Word of God. It used to be that our military was very concerned about immoral people within its ranks. They were considered a high risk to the intelligence community because they were felt to be prone to disloyalty and compromise. This could be more easily exploited. And we know that throughout the Cold War, this was a common tactic to ply our agents with women. Military secrets have been traded for centuries in bedroom situations as loose moral people with low values succumb to bribes and enticement of this type. To endorse now and to accept homosexuals now into the military to give them high government clearance in our country is a testimony to the core of the values of our society. Thus, David's transgression was huge and needed to be recorded for all thoughtful saints to ponder. And that applies to our young people coming up. This is the hardest generation in the last throes of our Laodicean society for people to live and for young people to come online and to try and maintain their spiritual vigilance. We acknowledge that as parents. That's a fact. It teaches lessons on sin management, forgiveness, grace, and mercy, which each of us need to be reminded of. Yet we have to remind ourselves, God forgave David. And it's later referred to as a man after God's own heart. Now ponder that. There is no sin that we can say has separated us effectively long term from the love of God as witness this story. David's sin magnifies out of control as the budding pregnancy of Bathsheba becomes a terrific and a perfect way of explaining this, both literally and in a metaphorical manner. The wisdom of Yahweh has structured things so that for man to go forth and to multiply, as was his charge in Genesis, that the cycle of a woman, followed by her days of purification, placed her at high fertility and a narrow window, and consequently Bathsheba became pregnant because of the situation. Although the growing of the conception began immediately, the awareness by the parties is often slow in coming. This makes sin so subtle and so dangerous. Unchecked sin, like smoking or drinking, can go on for some time without any side effects showing up. Just as Bathsheba's baby continued to grow, the consequences of unchecked sin continues to increase continually in size. In David's case, the growing of the consequences of his sin of adultery and premeditated murder would involve the increase of many evils in his home and government. Great rebellion, crime, tragedy and alienation would enter into David's life and family and continue on for the duration of his life. In addition, his government would become increasingly weakened and nearly be overthrown by revolt led from within his own household through his sons. Now, to quote from a commentary, when we have sinned in a high-profile manner, we are more eager to conceal it before men than to confess it before God. That's often the case, is it not? We want to cover this thing up and conceal it rather than taking it humbly to our Heavenly Father. The dilemma of now a growing baby is a perfect model to depict unforgiven sin. This was exactly the case we have here. Soon he would be found out. He tried two different ways to cover his sin. You see, where's the consultation with Yahweh at this point? David's totally on his own. He did his best to get Uriah to lie with Bathsheba. When that didn't work, he decided to marry her and next to engineer the death of Uriah. Both approaches went down a treacherous path that we can only wonder if this was really the David we knew earlier. Where was his head, for crying out loud? In 2 Samuel 11, here, verse 6 to 7, David summons Uriah home and asks him a generally legitimate question in verse 8. And in his small talk, basically he's trying to make it look like he calls him home to say, well, how are things going at the front? You know, you need a little break. How about some R&R? I want you to go down to thy house, wash thy feet, in verse 8, which is an idiom, and which means, this figure of speech means, go down, wash your feet, put your feet up, and settle in with your wife. David sent food from the palace kitchen to enhance the ambiance of the evening. To send food from the royal table was a high honor for an Eastern king to pay to any subordinate. It was essential for Uriah to go home and lie with his wife, as David could then father off the child, rightfully so, upon her husband. This was pure deceit. It began with David using his position of authority and influence to call Uriah home for what seemed to be a little respite from the war. People use their positions of authority to instigate sinful acts in every arena, be it our government, our schools, Penn State, you name it. So be aware of these scenarios. In verse 9, we're told that Uriah did not eat a bite, but Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all of the servants of his lord and went not down to his house. Uriah was a disciplined soldier, and this tells us that he was disciplined of mind, physically, and spiritually. He did not want to partake of ease, comforts, and the ambiance of his home when he knew that his men were sleeping out on the ground under siege in an army situation. And this, we might say, what is an attitude of the soldiers of Yahweh in every respect. Soldiers of Christ, arise and put your armor on, we know, is a spiritual suit of armor. It's not comforts and it's not laziness. To quote the Apostle Paul in 2 Timothy 2, endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. Uriah here was typifying the character that David used to manifest. this was not the David that we knew before. Now, David, in contrast, had slept until late afternoon. He loafed around on his deck, had an illicit affair with his neighbor, and totally compromised his own reputation as a disciplined warrior and person of character. And he had insulted God. David was displeased in verse 10 with Uriah's behavior, because in essence, Uriah was too straight. So don't let that mantra worry any of you if you are labeled as being too straight. The point here we have on the overhead: those who are principled and live godly lives will always be the target of those who do not. Godly conduct upsets those who are relaxed and laid back, especially other Christians who will call us too strict, straight-laced, extremist, puritanical, or even Thomasites. As a last resort, David gave Uriah another day of leave in town and plied him with more food and liquor. Despite all this, and no doubt feeling the effects of the wine, Uriah refused to go down to his wife and instead repeated his commitment, as we have recorded for us in verse 11. Uriah said unto David, "The ark and Israel and Judah abide in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are encamped in the open fields. Shall I then go into mine house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As thou livest and as thy soul liveth, I will not do this thing." He stood up to even the king. This reminds us of Christ's resolve to his temptations in the wilderness. Uriah would not yield to the temptations despite the extra day in Jerusalem. This brings us then to point number two on the overhead. When we are in the throes of sin and resisting it or contending against it, understand that it might be an uncomfortable, drawn-out situation that requires great personal effort and resolve. So we have David's logic as a type of sin in the flesh and in society in general. Sin is relentless, but can be countered by turning to God in prayer. At this time, David was operating totally on his own, reasoning as a man in the world, left to his own deceitful schemes. The injection of strong drink is here again for all ages to consider and to be forewarned of. For alcohol and liquor both loosens the tongue and typically looses the morals. And if you young people go to your various colleges, if that's your path, this is going to be a big factor, a big tempter. When Noah got drunk, he uncovered himself in a sinful way. When the daughters of Lot wanted to have a child, they made their father drunk so he would oblige their incestuous thoughts. Today, studies show that half of all car accidents are alcohol-related. Half of them. David had totally underestimated the character of Uriah. So we'll leave that as our class for today and pick up tomorrow.